Blessings of the Triple Gem, Theruvan Saranai. We are continuing with our series on profitable perceptions, which is based on the Buddha's teaching in the Tutiya Sanya Sutta, which is on Anguttara Nikaya Chapter 7, Discourse Number 49. In today's Dhamma session, we'll be looking at the perception of unattractiveness or foulness, also known as Asubhasanya in Pali. Let's begin by paying homage to the Triple Gem. We can bow our heads in Anjali. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dhamma, and homage to the Noble Sangha. As we highlighted in our introductory session, we will examine each of the profitable perceptions, and this is to clarify the Buddha's instructions and their meaning, and also to understand what they overcome and how to develop each one referencing other teachings of the Buddha where needed. And then in a final session, we will consolidate them so we can contemplate all seven perceptions as a single meditation. As the Buddha has said in the Tutiya Sanya Sutta, bhikkhus, these seven perceptions, when developed and cultivated, are of great fruit and benefit, culminating in the deathless, having deathless as their consummation. And as per the Raga Payala, these abbreviated texts on lust or greed, we can gain direct knowledge of lust or greed and much, much more. In this session, we'll be focusing on this perception of unattractiveness, which helps the mind to shrink away from sexual intercourse. And just as a reminder or word of caution, when it comes to the perception of unattractiveness, it is always good to develop it in accordance with the Buddha's instructions. We have previously developed it as part of the first doorway to Nibbana, culminating in immeasurable loving kindness or metta upamana. This is a safe way to cultivate it. And when we have gone through all seven profitable perceptions and are able to meditate on all seven perceptions as a set, this is another safe way to cultivate it. For this session, as we're gradually developing one perception at a time, it's advisable to cultivate some metta after contemplating the perception of unattractiveness. And this is to neutralize any ill effects that this might cause. For example, if you do 10 minutes of the perception of unattractiveness, then do 10 minutes of metta as well. Let's now deep dive into what the Buddha has said about the perception of unattractiveness in this Tutiya Sanya Sutta. It was said, the perception of unattractiveness, bhikkhus, when developed and cultivated, is of great fruit and benefit, culminating in the deathless, having deathless as its consummation. So we said before, deathless is reference to Nibbana. For what reason was this said? When a bhikkhu often dwells with a mind accustomed to the perception of unattractiveness, his mind shrinks away from sexual intercourse, turns back from it, rolls away from it, and is not drawn toward it, and either equanimity or revulsion becomes settled in him. Just as a cock's feather or strip of sinew thrown into a fire shrinks away from it, turns back from it, rolls away from it, and is not drawn towards it, so it is in regard to sexual intercourse when a bhikkhu often dwells with a mind accustomed to the perception of unattractiveness. This profitable perception of unattractiveness or foulness, asubhasanya, is not how we usually perceive forms or the physical nutriment. What we usually dwell in is the perception of attractiveness or the beautiful or what is pleasant, subhasanya. The Pedagogudesa or Pitaka disclosure states that the perception of attractiveness or the beautiful, so subhasanya, has the characteristic of apprehending or taking up color, shape, or appearance, and its footing is lack of sense restraint. So in Pali, this is vanna, sangahana, lakana, subhasanya, tassa, indriya, asangvaro, padattana. And this is in chapter 6 of Pedagogudesa. And we can realize the truth of this statement. When we're out in the world or using our smart gadgets to view things, we don't have sense restraint. We go out with our senses and keep taking up or collecting color and appearance of different forms. We assign beauty or attractiveness based on the outer color or appearance or its shape. For example, long or short hair, shiny versus dull, muscular versus flabby, fair versus dark skinned. or we comment on how people are dressed or the different kinds of appearance of foods and coloring and so on. And this is how the sign of attractive or beautiful is the nutriment for sensual desire, which is rooted in greed. It is only by developing the perception of unattractiveness or foulness that we overcome the perception of attractiveness or the beautiful. Otherwise, we allow the mind to keep connecting and establishing on the perception of attractiveness or beauty, and we cover up its true nature. And as a result, there is no equanimity or repulsiveness towards form. We won't be able to transcend form, is what the Buddha is really saying. So the Buddha has taught in the Ahara Sutta, this is Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 46, or discourse number 51, and this is regards to what nourishes hindrances. When we nourish the hindrances, we nourish greed, hatred, and delusion. So the Buddha says, and what bhikkhus is the nutriment for the arising of unarisen sensual desire and for the increase and expansion of arisen sensual desire? There is bhikkhus the sign of the beautiful. Frequent unwise contemplation to it is the nutriment of for the arising of unarisen sensual desire and for the increase and expansion of arisen sensual desire. So when the Buddha taught about the perception of unattractiveness or foulness, what is unpleasant, asubhasanya, he is now referring to denourishing sensual desire. So he says, and what bhikkhus is the denourishment that prevents unarisen sensual desire from arising and arisen sensual desire from increasing and expanding? There is bhikkhus the sign of unattractiveness or foulness. Frequent wise contemplation to it is the denourishment that prevents unarisen sensual desire from arising and arisen sensual desire from increasing and expanding. So what we can confirm here is the rising samudaya and passing away at dangama of sensual desire. And it's important to recognize the Buddha is correcting sick perception. We have seen forms as attractive, beautiful, pleasant, but the Buddha has encouraged us to see them correctly as unattractive, foul, or unpleasant. And it's in this way that we lean towards the truth, we lean towards Nibbana. We already know from our study of the four nutriments, particularly the first unprofitable direction, which begins with the physical nutriment, so Kapalin Kara, Ahara in Pali. And we know that this leads to going the wrong way due to desire, Chanda Agati Gamanam. So this unprofitable direction is the greed path. And this has the perversion or corruption that there is attractive in the unattractive, or sometimes said fair in the foul. When this is active, sensual desire increases and expands. And this is because of attachment or craving towards the physical nutriment. We're misapprehending it. There's poison in our mind. We have sick perceptions. So what happens is we take delight, welcome, and remain holding. Abhinandati, abhivadati, ajosayatitati in Pali. And of course, this activates dependent origination. And so we go the wrong way with desire for the world. And as a result, rebirth is not ended, and we experience this whole mass of suffering over and over again. This is our well-trodden greed path. With the Buddha's teaching, it's very important to understand that this bigger picture perspective, that this is our collective predicament unless we heed the Buddha's teaching. If we do so, then we come to realize that this well-trodden greed path is what we've been following to go from birth to birth in samsara. And so what we want to do is to heed the Buddha's words and denourish sensual desire by developing this profitable perception of unattractiveness and acquire the sign of unattractiveness. So how do we develop and cultivate the perception of unattractiveness or foulness? We know from the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya Discourse Number 10, one of the four establishments of mindfulness is the contemplation of the body as body, which includes contemplating 32 parts of the body as repulsive. In Pali, Kayanupassana, Patikula Manasikara, so the Buddha said, again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, bounded by skin as full of many kinds of impurity thus. In this body, there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. And of course, we add the brain as the 32nd part of the body. Just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends full of many sorts of grains, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus: this is hill rice, this is red rice, these are beans, these are peas, this is millet, this is white rice. So too, a bhikkhu reviews this same body as full of many kinds of impurity thus: in this body there are head hairs all the way to urine. Of course, we add the brain as well. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body, internally, externally, and both internally and externally. Or else he abides contemplating in the body its nature of arising, or he contemplates contemplating in the body its nature of vanishing, or he abides contemplating in the body its nature of both arising and vanishing, or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. So this is certainly Kayanupassana. So essentially there are 20 hard things, including the brain, and 12 liquid things that comprise the body. Here the Buddha is asking us to view the body like a bag filled with a variety of different items that we would open up to view each item individually. When we see the body simply as a bag, it is a unity of form. But when we view different items inside the bag, it is a diversity in its 32 diverse parts. We often get duped when we take the external or gross body as a whole. When we take it lumped like this, covered by skin, then we don't think about what's inside or under our skin. It's only when we look beneath the surface that we get the true picture. And at this point, we'll simply focus on the external or gross body. There's a deeper contemplation that can be done to contemplate the internal body after having contemplated the external body, and then contemplating both internal and external bodies and recognizing them then as the same. And this connects with the deeper contemplation of the enlightenment factor of mindfulness. And we'll save that for a later time, because it's probably better not to add too much complexity to developing this first profitable perception. Before we go into more detail into the 32 parts of the body, I'm giving an advanced trigger warning for those who don't want to see images of the 32 parts of the body. The reason why we're taking our time is because it's important to see the true nature of the body. That's the purpose of this. We can't transcend form unless we see the true nature, particularly of this body. So those who work in the medical field or similar often have a better idea about the true nature of the body. And from a worldly standpoint, we're always covering up the body or prettying it up or fixing it or simply being conditioned to avoid the truth. So for this reason, I've included pictures that are less cartoon-like but more realistic. But if you prefer not to view them and you're watching this as a video, you can skip ahead to the next part. So let's now go into these 32 parts of the body, taking a little time so we're not glossing over each part, nor assuming that we know what they are. The important thing is that if we do the contemplation and visualize them properly in our meditation, then we see the truth. We see the true nature of this body and not the lies. So we'll apply both the English and the Pali. So the first is head hairs, kesa. These are the protein filaments that grow from follicles found in the dermis on the head. So when it comes to head hair, we spend a lot of time and money on its appearance, the color and shape of our hairstyle. And also as we age, we cover up signs of aging. We usually take hair as subha, so attractive or beautiful. But then if you think when we're dining out and we find a strand of someone's hair in our plate of food, we freak out and send the food back and complain about it, complain how disgusting it is. When we say it's disgusting, this is when we see the true nature of the hair. So it's important not to hide the true nature of hair in our contemplation due to its color or appearance or its shape. Otherwise, we don't establish the perception of unattractiveness correctly. And just to point out, we don't have to make a problem out of going to the hairdresser or the barber and taking care of our hair, so long as we see the true nature in our meditation. Then we have body hairs, loma. Similar to head hairs, these are protein filaments that grow from follicles found in the dermis of the body. And then we have nails, naka. This is the protective plate found at the di tip of the digits of the fingers and also the toes. These are made out of tough, rigid protein called alpha keratin. So again, with the nails, when we paint our fingernails or toenails, we try to beautify their appearance. When we trim them, we try to make the shape look nice. So when we see, for example, an ingrown toenail, or we see a pile of someone who's cut their fingernails and toenails, then we'd be disgusted. So the latter, when we see the true, is when we see the true nature of the nail. So it's important, again, not to hide the true nature of nails in our contemplation due to the shape or color or appearance. Otherwise, we don't establish the perception of unattractiveness. And again, we don't have to make a problem out of if we want to apply nail polish or gloss, so long as in our meditation we do see the true nature of nail. Then we have teeth. So this is danta in Pali. This is the calcified whitish structure in human mouths that is used to break down food. So these days, the appearance of our teeth is valued highly. We often see people, such as celebrities, they go for veneers or they have treatments to whiten the teeth and to file them into a particular shape. So in reality, teeth are subject to discoloring and decay as they age. It's important to not hide the true nature of teeth in our contemplation due to its color or appearance. Otherwise, we don't establish, again, this perception of unattractiveness. Again, we don't have to make a problem out of taking care of our teeth, so long as in our meditation we see the true nature of our teeth. Then we have skin. This is the body's largest organ that forms the outer surface of the body. The skin protects against germs, regulates the body's temperature, and enables touch or tactile sensations. So, as a society, we value youthful skin, fair skin, glowing skin, unblemished skin, soft skin, skin that isn't riddled with sickness, and so on. But the skin is continually aging and it is also subject to sickness. And we shed old skin cells every day and have new skin every 30 days. So we're all subject to aging and have a variety of skin ailments as well. So it's important not to hide the true nature of skin in our contemplation due to its color or appearance. And this applies to whether it's a baby versus a younger child versus someone who's older. Even a child has aging skin. And so it's important to make sure in our meditation we establish the perception of unattractiveness. So with these, the rest of these parts of the body, I'll go over more of their function and qualities. So we come to flesh, mangsang. This encompasses muscles under the skin that store tissue filling in the body. Sinews, naharu. This encompasses sinews, tendons, ligaments and cartilage in the body. They're tough bands of dense, fibrous connective tissue that connects muscle to the bone. It sends mechanical forces of muscle contraction to the skeletal system while withstanding tension. Then we come to bones, ati. This constitutes the internal skeleton of the body. Bones protect various other organs of the body, produce red and white blood cells, store minerals, provide structure and support for the body, and enable mobility. And then we have bone marrow, ati minjang. These are the spongy tissue on the inside of the bones. It produces blood cells and later becomes responsible for storing fat and certain stem cells. Then we have kidneys, bakang. These are the two reddish brown bean shaped blood filtering organs. They receive blood from the paired renal arteries. Blood exits into the paired renal veins. Each kidney is attached to a ureter, a tube that carries excreted urine to the bladder. The kidney participates in the control of the volume of various blood fluids, fluid osmolality, acid-base balance, various electrolyte concentrations, and removal of toxins. Then we have the heart, hridayam. This is the muscular organ that pumps blood through the blood vessels of the circulatory system. The pumped blood carries oxygen and nutrients to the body while carrying metabolic waste such as carbon dioxide to the lungs. Then we have the liver, yakanang. This is the major metabolic organ which performs many essential biological functions, such as detoxification and the synthesis of proteins and biochemicals necessary for digestion and growth. Then we have the diaphragm, kilomakang. It's the most important muscle of respiration and separates the chest cavity containing the heart and lungs from the abdominal cavity. Then we have the spleen, pihakang. This is to the left of the stomach, below the diaphragm. It serves to store blood, disintegrate old blood cells, and filters foreign substances from the blood and produces lymphocytes. Then we have the lungs, pa pa sung. That's the primary organs of the respiratory system. They flank the heart and great vessels in the chest cavity. Their function in the respiratory system is to extract oxygen from the air and transfer it into the bloodstream and to release carbon dioxide from the bloodstream into the atmosphere in a process of gas exchange. Then we have the intestines. This is antang. This is part of the gastrointestinal tract, and together the small and large intestines run from the end of the stomach to the anus. The intestines work by absorbing nutrients and vitamins. Then we have mesentery, antagunang. This is the organ that attaches the intestines to the posterior abdominal wall and is formed by the double fold of peritoneum. It helps in storing fat and allowing blood vessels, lymphatics, and nerves to supply the intestines, among other functions. Then we have contents of the stomach, udaryang. The stomach is located between the esophagus and the small intestine. The stomach is the distensible organ that secretes digestive enzymes and gastric acid to aid in food digestion. Since enzymes in the small intestine digest fat slowly, food can stay in the stomach for 6 hours or longer when the duodenum is processing fatty chyme. However, this still is a fraction of the 24 to 72 hours that full digestion typically takes from start to finish. Then we have feces. So this is karisang. This is also known as stool or human waste, and it's the solid or semi-solid remains of food that was not digested in the small intestine, and it has been broken down by bacteria in the large intestine. Feces contain a relatively small amount of metabolic waste products such as bacterially altered bilirubin and dead epithelial cells from the lining of the gut. Normally, human feces has a mucus coating, and feces is discharged to the anus through defecation. And I've included brain up here to complete the 20 hard parts of the body. So this in Pali is Matalunga. The brain is the organ that serves as the center of the nervous system. It controls most of the activities of the body, processing, integrating, and coordinating the information it receives from the sense organs, and making decisions as to the instructions sent to the rest of the body. The brain is contained in and protected by the skull bones of the head. So now we have the liquid parts of the body. So we have bile, pittang, also known as gall. And this is the yellow-green fluid produced by the liver of most vertebrates that aids the digestion of lipids in the small intestines. In humans, bile is primarily composed of water produced continuously by the liver and stored and concentrated in the gallbladder. After we eat, this stored bile is discharged into the first section of our small intestine. Then we have phlegm, semhung. And this is mucus produced by the respiratory system, excluded that produced by the nasal passages. So it often refers to respiratory mucus expelled by coughing, otherwise known as sputum. And phlegm and mucus as a whole is in essence a water-based gel consisting of glycoproteins, immunoglobulins, lipids, and other substances. And phlegm tends to be thicker and stickier. Then we have pus. This is pubo, and this is a fluid emitted typically white, yellow, or yellow brown, formed at the site of inflammation during bacterial or fungal infection. An accumulation of pus in an enclosed tissue space is known as an abscess, whereas a visible collection of pus within or beneath the epidermis is known as pustule, pimple, or spot. And then we have blood, lohitang. This is the fluid that transports oxygen and nutrients to cells and carries away carbon dioxide and other waste products. Blood is composed of blood cells suspended in blood plasma. Plasma, which constitutes 55% of blood fluid, is mostly water, and contains proteins, glucose, mineral ions, hormones, carbon dioxide, and blood cells themselves. Then we have sweat, seddo. This is also known as perspiration and is the fluid secreted by sweat glands. Sweating is primarily a means of thermoregulation. It contributes to body odor when it is metabolized by bacteria on the skin. Then we have fat, meddo. This is what is stored within fat cells throughout the body. It gives the body energy, protects organs, supports cell growth, keeps cholesterol and blood pressure under control, and helps the body absorb vital nutrients. Then we have tears, asu. This is the clear liquid secreted by the lacrimal glands found in the eyes of all land mammals. Tears are made up of water, electrolytes, proteins, lipids, and nutrients that form layers on the surface of the eyes. Then we have grease, wasa, also referred to as tallow. This is the oily or waxy matter which lubricates the hair and skin, and it's most commonly on the face and scalp. Then we have spittle, kelo. This is referred to as spit or saliva. This is the extracellular fluid produced and secreted by the salivary glands in the mouth. In humans, saliva is around 99% water, plus electrolytes, mucus, white blood cells, epithelial cells, enzymes, antimicrobial agents. And the enzymes found in saliva are essential in beginning the process of digestion of dietary starches and fats. And these enzymes also play a role in breaking down food particles entrapped within dental crevices, which protect teeth from bacterial decay. Saliva also performs a lubricating function, wetting food and permitting the initiation of swallowing and protecting oral mucosa from drying out. Then we have snot, Tsinganika, and this is mucus produced by the nasal passages. The nose and throat are lined with glands that produce 1 to 2 quarts of mucus every day, and we swallow the mucus all day long without knowing it. The main job of nasal mucus is to keep the linings of the nose and sinuses moist, trap dust and other particles that are inhaled, fight infections, and also help moisten the air we inhale and make it easier to breathe. And then we have oil of the joints, lasica, also known as synovial fluid or synovia. It is the thick, viscous fluid with an egg white-like consistency that lubricates and reduces friction between joints. It's like the body's lubricant. When synovial fluid is low, which tends to happen with age, it can contribute to joint stiffness and other aging-related joint conditions like osteoarthritis. And then lastly, we have urine, mutang. This is a liquid byproduct of metabolism in humans and in many other animals. Urine flows from kidneys through ureters to the urinary bladder. Urination results in urine being excreted from the body through the urethra. So those are the 32 parts of the body. So if we correctly contemplate one part of the body in meditation, you can see it can be very powerful, but even more so, all 32 parts of the body, and also to visualize it. We also understand that all these 32 parts of the body are subject to aging and sickness. It also adds to the unattractiveness of the body. When you do a Google search of images, what comes up for these various parts of the body, particularly the organs of the body, is you see them in different states. You see them in their sickly states as well as their healthy state. And you also see them as they age. So what we see by doing this contemplation is that the body is not reliable. It's fragile, it's subject to change, subject to decay, and so there's much suffering that comes with this body. When there's a strong sense of unattractiveness of the body, when it's prominent and strong, it certainly removes any sense of attractiveness of the body. And this is, of course, beneficial to the Noble Eightfold Path. And as mentioned earlier, it's advisable to cultivate loving kindness after doing this contemplation. So, another reminder, so we don't suffer any ill effects. And when we contemplate these 32 parts of the body, we need to also understand the arising and passing away phenomena. We are reminding ourselves of dependent origination. So in Pali, Paticca-samuppada, again, if we perceive any parts of this body as attractive or beautiful, then we tend to take delight, welcome, and remain holding. And because of that, craving arises. If there's craving, there's delight. Then there's clinging, wanting to come to existence. There's birth, and due to birth, there's aging and death, and of course, this whole mass of suffering. So the key questions to ask when we do this meditation is, how did these 32 unattractive parts of the body come to arise, and how do they pass away? If we correctly activate this perception of unattractiveness or foulness, then what happens is we naturally don't take delight, don't welcome, and don't remain holding. So in Pali, nabhinandati, nabhivadati. So there's no delight. If there's no delight, we cut off clinging. If we cut off clinging, we cut off existence. If we cut off existence, we cut off birth. If we cut off birth, then there's no aging and death, and so there's no more suffering. And due to the nature of this meditation, we can see that this is a contemplation that we want to do in formal meditation. So this is not something that we do when we go about our daily life, when we're sitting in the car or on public transport or when we're at work or having a conversation with somebody. No, this is something we do in formal meditation, because if we try to do this in daily life, it will completely turn us off from everything and we wouldn't be able to get anything done. And this is not the intention of the contemplation. So, but if, for example, we do this contemplation in meditation and we want to take this forward and maintain it to a certain degree, then skillful meditators, what they do is they take something like the bones or the skeleton as skillful means, particularly if they have contemplated it well. And so when they're out in the world, then they can quickly uplift the mind to remove any preference or delight towards color, shape, and appearance, particularly of bodies. And this gives a sense of calm and a sense of equanimity. And so skillful meditators find that quite easy to activate and then to uplift the mind to the perception of unattractiveness of the body using that particular body part and to maintain it in daily life. Another sutta that is helpful to establish the perception of unattractiveness or foulness, so this Asubha Sanya, is the Gandha Sutta. This is Anguttara Nikaya, chapter 9, discourse number 15. Here the Buddha has taught, bhikkhus, suppose there was a boil many years old, it would have nine wound orifices, nine natural orifices. Whatever would flow out from them would be impure, foul-smelling, and disgusting. Whatever would ooze out from them would be impure, foul-smelling, and disgusting. A boil, bhikkhus, is a designation for this body, consisting of the four great elements, originating from mother and father, built up out of rice and gruel, subject to impermanence, to kneading and abrasion, to breaking apart and dispersal. It has nine wound orifices, nine natural orifices. Whatever flows out from them is impure, foul-smelling, and disgusting. Whatever oozes out from them is impure, foul-smelling, and disgusting. Therefore, bhikkhus, become disenchanted with this body. This contemplation, as we can see, is straightforward. The Buddha has explained, if we contemplate the nine holes or orifices in our bodies, similar to the simile of the boil. So he's talking about the two holes for the eyes, two holes for the ears, two holes for the nose, one hole for the mouth, one hole for urination, one hole for defecation, making the total of nine holes. And we consider the impurities that flow out or ooze out from each of these holes, and we see them as impure, foul-smelling, and disgusting. And so the perception of unattractiveness naturally arises. So you only have to contemplate any one of these holes, and it's already like that. So this is often why meditators who develop the perception of unattractiveness in this way often call these bodies walking toilets or walking, flowing out of impurity. And so this is easy enough to contemplate with our own body, given our familiarity with it and how much we tend to clean it because there's so many impurities flowing out from it, and not just through the holes, but even from out the pores of our skin. So the fact that we tend to clean it frequently already tells us something. And we can also see the aging and sickness in the body over time as well. So it's also helpful to contemplate other people's bodies in the same way in our meditation, so we don't hide the true nature for everybody else. So, for example, we might see what most people call an attractive man or woman on the street or on the television. And What we need to do is, in our meditation, remember what we've seen and also think about that person as having, again, flowing, what's flowing out from their nine holes, what's oozing out from their nine holes. Of course, it's foul smelling, disgusting, and impure. So, in this way, the core idea is that we're not glorifying the body in our meditation. We're not trying to cover up the truth in our meditation regarding these bodies. And again, just a reminder, we need to see the arising and passing away phenomena. And also, it's very good, even with this particular meditation, to make sure we do equal amounts of loving kindness at the end of doing the meditation. So, at least there's no ill effects. Okay, so let's go back to the Dutiyasanya Sutta. So the Buddha then says, if when a bhikkhu often dwells with a mind accustomed to the perception of unattractiveness, his mind inclines to sexual intercourse, or if he does not turn away from it, he should understand. I have not developed the perception of unattractiveness. There is no distinction between my earlier condition and my present one. I have not attained the fruit of development. Thus, he clearly comprehends this. What the Buddha has stated here is a check for whether we have developed the perception of unattractiveness properly. Here he said, if we do our contemplation, whether it's on the 32 parts of the body or what flows from the nine holes in the body, our mind inclines to sexual intercourse or doesn't turn away from it, then we should understand we haven't developed the perception of unattractiveness properly. Or the way we have contemplated or applied the Dhamma in this meditation is wrong, because there is no difference in the mind before and after the contemplation. So there's no fruit of development. So when this is the case, it's important to go back and review our meditation to see where we may have gone wrong, whether we're still taking something as attractive or beautiful, handsome or pleasing, and that is what is covering up the truth. And then the Buddha said, but if, when he often dwells with a mind accustomed to the perception of unattractiveness, his mind shrinks away from sexual intercourse, turns back from it, rolls away from it, and is not drawn towards it, and either equanimity or revulsion becomes settled in him, he should understand, I have developed the perception of unattractiveness. That is a distinction between my earlier condition and my present one. I have attained the fruit of development. Thus, he clearly comprehends this. So, in contrast with the earlier one, after contemplating, our mind shrinks away from sexual intercourse and is not drawn towards it, and neither equanimity or revulsion settles in us. Then we understand we have developed this asubhasanya or perception of unattractiveness properly, because there's a distinction, a difference from before and after our contemplation. So, we can say there's fruit of development. That means we're able to transcend form. So if this is the case, then we're happy that we've developed this well. So when it was said, the perception of unattractiveness, bhikkhus, when developed and cultivated, is of great fruit and benefit, culminating in the deathless, having the deathless as its consummation, it is because of this that this was said. So the Buddha has confirmed that when we develop and cultivate the perception of unattractiveness, it's of great fruit and benefit because nibbana is the final goal and accomplishment. So, why has Buddha said this? Well, when we develop and cultivate the perception of unattractiveness properly, it means we firstly understand form, we understand rupa in Pali, and it also means we understand the physical nutriment as it really is. And we also know how it comes to arise and how it comes to pass away. And so, with the breakup of the body after death, we would be able to uplift the mind to the perception of unattractiveness of the body so it does not incline towards constructing a similar birth with such a form in such a realm as this or lower. So, we also know it's possible to be born into the womb of an animal, for example. And so, if we shrink away from sexual intercourse, turn back from it, roll back from it, and not be drawn toward it because it's basic biology. So we've looked at this when we examined the greed path meditation, and more importantly, also when we looked at the first unprofitable direction, which we referred to early in this session, starting with the physical nutriment. So in the meditation, if you meditate on it very well, one can attain liberation, and this is vimutti. So either cetu vimutti or panya vimutti is possible in this meditation. And what this means is that one has transcended form in the meditation. So, to provide a bit of inspiration and encouragement for this first profitable perception of Asubhasanya, I thought we'd take a look at one of the foremost disciples of the Buddha, someone who's a worthy role model. And this role model is Venerable Nanda Theri, who the Buddha has said is the foremost of his bhikkhuni disciples among meditators or those who practice absorption or jhana. So this is Jayinang Yadidang Nanda. So Venerable Nanda Theri was also known by many names in the Pali Canon, Rupananda, Janapada Kalyani, and also Sundari Nanda. And there's an interesting account about her with reference to Dhammapada verse number 150. And at the time, the Buddha was residing at Jetavana Monastery. So the Dhammapada commentary tells us that Princess Janapada Kalyani was the daughter of Gautami, the stepmother of Gautama the Buddha. And because she was very beautiful, she was also known as Rupananda. She was married to Prince Nanda, a cousin of the Buddha. And as a quick aside, we've previously spoken about Venerable Nanda Thera as the foremost of the bhikkhu disciples among those who guard the doors of the sense faculties. So anyway, one day Princess Janapada Kalyani pondered, "My husband and mother, as well as other relatives, have gone forth. Without these relatives, the household life is suffering." Thus, she went forth, not from faith or conviction, but because she did not find any enjoyment in the household life. Because of infatuation with her own beauty, Nanda Theri, as she became known, did not want to attend upon the Blessed One. She did not even want to see him because she thought the Blessed One speaks dispraise of form, criticizes it, and in many ways shows the danger in form. But other bhikkhunis coming back from the monastery kept talking in praise of the Buddha. So she told the bhikkhunis that she wished to see the Blessed One. The bhikkhunis took her and approached the Blessed One. The Blessed One knew in advance she would be coming, and so, like a man wishing to remove one thorn with another or one spike with another, he set out to remove her infatuation with beauty by means of beauty itself. Using his own supernormal power, he created an extremely beautiful woman, 15 or 16 years of age, standing by his side, fanning him. When Nanda arrived, along with other bhikkhunis, she paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down among the bhikkhunis, and saw the excellence of the Blessed One's form, which extended even up to the tips of his hairs. Then, when she saw the mind-created form standing by his side, she lost her infatuation with her own beauty and became enthralled with the other woman's beauty. She thought, "Oh, this woman is truly beautiful." Then the Blessed One displayed that woman as having reached the age of 20. For women to excel in beauty when they are 16 years of age, but not beyond that. When Nanda Theri saw the woman's beauty decline, her fascination with her form diminished. The Blessed One then displayed the woman as one who had never given birth, as one who had given birth once, as a middle-aged woman, as an old woman. He then showed her getting older until she was 100 years old, bent over, leaning on a walking stick with pock-marked limbs. While Nanda was still looking on, he showed the woman die, and her body bloated and in various stages of decay, surrounded by crows and other scavengers, being devoured, foul-smelling, disgusting, and repulsive. Having seen that sequence of decay, Nanda thought, "This sequence is common to all, to me as well as to others." The perception of impermanence sprang up in her, and in conformity with it, the perceptions of suffering and not self, or not me and mine, arose. The three kinds of existence then appeared to her as like a blazing house not offering any refuge. Thus, she came to perceive the true nature of form. Then, knowing that Nanda's mind had settled on a meditation subject, the Blessed One recited these verses on account of their suitability. "Behold, Nanda, this assemblage afflicted, impure, putrid, flowing and oozing, delighted in by fools, as this so that, as that so this, by way of elements, see it as empty, do not come back to the world again. Having expunged desire for existence, you will live at peace." And at the conclusion of the verses, Nanda Theri was established in the fruit of stream entry, so she became or realized Sotapanna. Then the Buddha spoke the Dhammapada verse as follows: Adinang Nagarang Katang, in this city built of bones, Mangsa Lohita Lepanang, plastered with flesh and blood, Yata Jara Chamachucha, where old age and death, Mano Mako Cha Ohito, conceit and derogation are deposited. And then to lead her to the achievement of the higher paths, the Blessed One spoke the discourse known as Vijaya Sutta. So this is in Sutta Nipata, chapter 1, discourse number 11. And he explained further, but we won't go into this discourse here, but it's also a very powerful sutta for developing a Subhasanya. And at the end of that discourse, Nanda Theri attained arahantship. So full enlightenment, extinguishment, nibbana. So we can see from this story the power of seeing the true nature of this body through the profitable perception of unattractiveness of foulness. And also we see how it connects with the perception of impermanence and all these other things as well. So with the help of the Buddha conjuring up the image of a beautiful girl transforming at stages into an old and then decrepit woman who eventually died, Venerable Nanda Theri was able to realize great fruit and benefit. And so the Buddha has given similar kinds of teaching with regard to beauty to other bhikkhunis, including Venerable Khema Theri, as we know. And we know from the first doorway to nibbana, painful practice with slow realization, that when we overcome the perversion of attractive in the unattractive by contemplating the unattractiveness of the body as one of the means, we can reach the first jhana. And then we correctly contemplate the arising and passing away of form, so kayanupassana, and we see at least one link in dependent origination, we can reach the heavenly abode or the four jhanas. So in this way, by developing and cultivating such a powerful contemplation of the body, we can see why Venerable Nanda Theri became foremost of the Buddha's bhikkhuni disciples who practice absorption or the jhanas. And we also know that that particular first doorway to nibbana culminates in immeasurable metta, loving kindness. So the First Noble Truth underpins that, understanding the suffering, the harm that is caused by birthing form, birthing a body. So this is very good encouragement for us to be brave, to be skilled by developing the profitable perception of unattractiveness or foulness when we contemplate the body. So Venerable Nanda Theri's verses in the Therigatha are also very powerful as a contemplation, because when we reflect on how deeply she has taken the Buddha's words to develop her practice. So this appears in Sundari Nanda Therigatha, and this is Therigatha chapter 5, discourse number 4, or verse number 4. Sick, putrid, unclean, look, Nanda, at this physical heap, through contemplation of the foul, develop the mind, make it unified, well restrained. As is your body, so is that. As is that, so is this. It gives off a foul stench, the delight of fools. Considering it thus, untiring, both day and night, with my own wisdom, I was disgusted with what I perceived. As I dwelt vigilant, examining it wisely, or examined it wisely, this body, as it actually is, was seen internally and externally, then being disgusted with the body, dispassionate, internally, vigilant, detached, I am calmed and become extinguished. So that's a very wonderful few verses to actually contemplate of Venerable Nanda Theri. And you can see that she was glorifying the perception of unattractiveness rather than beauty. And when we go to even Samyutta Nikaya, what you see is often Mara, there are accounts of Mara coming to entice bhikkhunis in particular with beauty, saying, go back to beauty, go back to seeing and taking delight in that in the world. And so it's very good to heed these words of Venerable Nanda Theri, someone who's very good at the jhanas, who's clearly penetrated, reached arahantship with the helpful aid of the Buddha. So we've now come to the end of our session on the first of the seven profitable perceptions, the perception of unattractiveness or foulness, a Subhasanya in Pali. So let's express our gratitude to the Buddha for this powerful teaching. Let's also express gratitude to our other teachers, parents, and good friends, those that encourage us on the Noble Eightfold Path. We can share the merits with all sentient beings. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be free from suffering. Blessings of the Triple Gem. Wishing you well. Theruvan Saranai.